trying to lay us up to dust as if they religious, and somebody must fail. Who does if it's my people that flock with no bail? I'm trying to stay independent from this hell life, but fail and leave away.
Welcome back. This is KPFK 90.7 FM, and my name is Tammy Bang Lu. So, with 2 million people incarcerated, the United States holds 25% of the world's prisoners, ranking it as the world's leading jailer. The U.S. is incarcerating black men at approximately 4 times the rate of incarceration of black men in South Africa during apartheid. The number of black men in prison, close to 800,000, has already equaled the number of men enslaved in 1920. If this current trend continues, only 15 years remain before the United States incarcerates as many African American men as were forced into chattel bondage at slavery's peak in 1860. These are the quotes taken from the article, The Drug War is the New Jim Crow, which was first published in NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. With us today is the author of that article, Graham Boyd. He's the founder and director of ACLU's Drug Policy Litigation Project. Graham Boyd, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Yeah. I just reread your article this morning preparing for the show, and it was just as powerful as when I read it the first time. You know, you overlay this argument based on you're trying to talk about slavery, Jim Crow, and this drug war, and making correlations, using three main points as the unprecedented rate of incarceration, the disenfranchisement of former felons, and prisons as plantations. Can you go into each of them and explain this argument of why the drug war is now the separate and unequal state of Jim Crow?
Sure. I mean, really for me the starting point is just noticing the phenomenal rate at which we're locking people of all races up, but then the fact that there's such an intense focus, especially on African Americans, in the drug war. If you can picture a chart of incarceration rates in this country as a rate of the total population, it's virtually a flat line through the history of this country, and until you get to the war on drugs, and then it just shoots through the roof. And we're locking up people in a way that no country has ever done at any time in all of recorded history. And we're doing it largely because of what people put into their bodies, the drugs they choose to take, or for selling those drugs to other people. So I started asking, you know, what is this about, and why are we sitting by and letting this drug war escalate, get more and more and more? What is it that allows us to do that? What kind of fear, what kind of irrationality would allow it? And I think one of the things that really strikes me is that there is no longer the acceptance of the kind of overt and blatant racism that slavery involved, or even the Jim Crow laws involved. I think there's a general acceptance among most people that sort of thing was wrong, and we wouldn't allow that to happen today. And yet you see it reproduced in the statistical way that I think says something about how the country is willing to tolerate it only if we collectively get scared enough. And so it's all about drug policy now. I think it's all about trying to make people accept the idea the only way to keep ourselves safe from the scourge of drugs, to protect our children, is to lock up the bad, scary people. And for many Americans, that basically means African Americans. You wanted me to talk some about, you know, the parallels. Certainly the numbers are powerful. The fact that we have as many people in prison today, as many black men in prison today as there were on the plantation in 1820, and that we're heading to basically having as many people and as many black men in prison as there ever were in slavery in the very near future. I mean, that's got to give you pause. That's got to make you think what's going on about that. And I thought about, well, what are some other parallels? One of them is about, I think, the separation of families. In reading back to slave narratives, I guess Frederick Douglass is the one that people are most familiar with, but that's one of the things that is often brought front and center is the idea that when a child is born on the plantation, the master can take the child away, often does, as soon as it can be weaned or at some later time and sold away from the family. There's a reality going on right now that we're locking up African American women more and more. And at the same time, there's a federal law that requires that when a child has been out of the custody of parents, in other words, in a foster home for a certain period of time, typically 15 months, that the child can be permanently adopted. Now, this is something I didn't go into in the article, but I've been thinking about it since then. And so there is this phenomenon now of families being separated, not just by arrests of parents, millions of families being separated, but actually being broken up by force of law, by the state coming in and saying that this child can no longer be with this parent ever again, that bond is permanently broken. Drug testing of African-American women is another engine for that kind of separation, the selective targeting of black women for drug testing because they are suspected of being drug users, and when the tests come up positive, again, Child Protective Services can get involved with no evidence that the mother is a bad parent, other than the fact that there is a trace of drugs in her blood, and that becomes cause for tearing a family apart in some states. You mentioned voting. One of the things that I think is most shameful about the original Constitution is the Three-Fifths Compromise, the idea that slaves could be counted for representational purposes and the census to basically count how much a area would be represented, but of course the slaves couldn't vote. And that kind of both taking power away from a person who has dark skin, but then even transferring that power over to the white people who own the plantation, that's still going on in a way, in a different form, of course, but they're right now in 10 states, most of them southern, 20% of adult black men have lost the right to vote because of a felony conviction. In many states, that losing the right to vote is permanent. In some states, it's as high as a third of adult black men. So, for instance, Florida and Alabama, the numbers are that high. But losing the right to vote and the ability to vote is bizarrely actually translated into political power for the place where prisoners are taken. So this is something you hear about, especially in New York State, where the incarceration of drug war prisoners takes place mainly on the streets of New York City, largely non-whites, African-Americans and Latinos, who are then shipped upstate to largely white rural communities where they're counted in the census. And those bring more representation to those communities, bring more benefits in terms of grants and loans and so forth, because they have a greater population. But that population is largely, you know, is significantly increased by the prisoners who are there who can't themselves vote while they're prisoners. Education is another part of it. Slavery was very much about, and Jim Crow too, very much about denying education to people by race. There's now a federal law, the Higher Education Amendments Act, that takes away financial aid for only one crime, drug crimes. You can murder, rape, arson, those things are all crimes, but you can keep your student loans and go to college. But if you smoke marijuana and get caught, you stand to lose your financial aid. And since drug law enforcement focuses so much on people of color, it's once again another tool of just saying we are creating an ever more permanent divide between groups of people that is largely defined by race.
Yeah.
And the last point, too, is just about health. The suffering that has happened under chattel slavery and under Jim Crow of people who were the victims of those systems, just in terms of their health and well-being, is maybe not something you talk about on the political level, but it's a very real thing. And if you think about AIDS right now, African Americans are 12% of the U.S. population, but 41% of current AIDS cases. And in terms of new AIDS cases, the sort of increasing trends in HIV and AIDS, 67% of new cases are African Americans. It's two-thirds. And it's one of the leading causes of death among black women ages 25 to 44. Now, where is that HIV infection coming from? For these African American women for whom AIDS is a leading cause of death, 65% of them got HIV in the first instance because someone shared a needle. So we have an official policy in this country and in many states of not allowing needle exchange, certainly not funding it, but in some states not even allowing it. And that would prevent those infections from taking place. But we're standing by because of the drug war and letting the epidemic increase, letting the health consequences increase, and letting those racialized disparities be very much a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you're listening to KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles and 98.7 in Santa Barbara. This is Tammy Bang Lu, and I'm speaking with Graham Boyd. You know, this brings in, I mean, what you were talking about earlier, it brings in the Florida elections. And you wrote in your article that over 200,000 African Americans in that state were barred from that election. And that could have shifted the vote.
But I mean, it would have shifted the vote. There's no doubt about it, because the vote tallies show that African American voters voted overwhelmingly for Gore over Bush. And so if those 200,000 people had been allowed to vote, that would have more than made up for the several hundred votes that ended up being the margin of difference between Bush versus Gore. But the other thing I said in the article, too, that is, I guess, at best ironic, is that the reason that so many of those individuals had lost the right to vote was because of drug convictions that had taken place under President Clinton. The drug war escalated enormously, beginning with Reagan, but continuing full force through Clinton's 8 years in office. And so a very significant number of people who were arrested in Florida and throughout the country were part of this ever-escalating war on drugs that has been taking place under both political parties. It's really not something you can put on one or the other.
I mean, that's correct. We just had Ron Daniels with us earlier in this segment, and it's talking about if we're going to actually try to push to get Bush out of office and we're going to create some independency as well as some coalitional work with the Democratic Party, then we really have to make some serious demands on the Democratic Party, and one of them is these mandatory sentencing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the kind of sentence that people can get for relatively minor drug crimes can be just staggering. But I would say in some ways that's just the ending point. I think the starting point for me is about the investigations and arrests and prosecutions. I mean, before you even get to the sentencing, we're doing a case right now in a little town called Hearne, Texas. I think a lot of people have heard about Tulia, which is something the ACLU has been involved in sort of in the early stages of it, where there was one sort of corrupt police officer named Tom Coleman, allegedly a member of the KKK himself, and he went and was an undercover officer and claimed to have bought drugs from a number of African Americans, and turns out he was lying. He made it up. The next case, the one that I think you're going to be hearing a lot about in the coming months, is in another small Texas town where the entire drug task force was corrupt enough that they would go around arresting 15% of the black men in town every year. And these massive raids, they would come in with sort of stormtrooper tactics and a helicopter and just round up the black community. And the latest raid involved an informant who they had recruited by threatening to kill him, by threatening to arrest his family, and basically telling him, go up and round up the following people. They gave him a list, told him who to arrest, and told him how to fabricate evidence. And we've uncovered all of this and have brought a lawsuit against them. But it's just, the Tulia and the Hearns, the sort of small towns in Texas, I think, tell an extreme story, but it's what's happening in communities all across the country, which is police are given leeway to fight the war on drugs. What they're really fighting are members of our own communities. And they do it by whatever means they decide to do it. I think there are some police forces who probably do it with a certain degree of integrity, but there are many others who purposely focus on low-income communities of color. And that's the beginning of these statistics, the disparities in terms of arrests overall and incarceration rates overall, and ultimately the disparities in terms of who you find behind bars and who can't vote. So we've got to get it at the very beginning, and we've got to hold our police forces accountable in the same way that I think, people have been calling for the last decade to really end the racial profiling and highway stops. We've got to stand up and equally call for the end to racial profiling and drug arrests. It's just outrageous.
Yeah, we've got two more minutes. I mean, one of the things I wanted to highlight is that it was stated that even though whites are five times more likely to use drugs and overwhelmingly the largest population, they're actually arrested. I mean, African Americans are arrested at 13.4 times greater. So let's talk about that a little bit. And then also, you ended it by saying we need a new civil rights movement to address this growing Jim Crow. So can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, the statistics are that people use drugs at the same rate no matter what race they are. It's about 13% of any racial group uses drugs to some extent. I am picking up some other noise on here. I'm sorry. I if that's not on my end. But about the same percentage of people, regardless of race, use drugs. But since there's so many more white people, five times as many white people in this country, that means that the vast majority of drug users are white, as you said. And yet the vast majority of people that we lock up are black. And the disparities in some states are even 50 to 1. In Illinois, it's 50 to 1 disparity in terms of black versus white of people being locked up. I think, you know, in terms of calling for a new civil rights movement, I think what is difficult is that there is a hesitancy to embrace anyone who is doing something illegal. If someone's using drugs or selling drugs, I think a lot of people want to just be like, well, we don't want to deal with that, but we've got to deal with it. People who use drugs are in every community, they're every race, they're every income, they're everywhere. They are our families, our friends, and we've got to deal with the fact that people are being locked up and their constitution is being shredded, all in the name of this war on drugs, which has effects that are far-ranging. So I think we've just got to put that behind us and say that the civil rights movement, the movement for voting rights, for education rights, for all of that, is about ending this massive rate of incarceration of people and arrest of people and harassment of people, all in the name of fighting the war on drugs. We've got to end that.
Thank you so much. So we had Grant Boyd with us, the director and founder of the ACLU Drug Litigation. Now we'll be right back after a short break, and we'll be speaking with Ron Washington from the Black Telephone Workers for Justice.